I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Of all the staff writers at The New Yorker magazine, Susan Orlean covers perhaps the most ground thematically and geographically. She's been embedded with fertility shamans in Bhutan and orchid thieves in Louisiana. She's profiled a dog, a boxer named Biff, and the entire city of Midland, Texas. She combines a deep emotional understanding of her subjects with rigorous reporting, and she spends pretty much as long as she likes on each project. If that weren't enough, her book, The Orchid Thief, inspired adaptation, one of the more successful art house movies of the past 20 years. Her most recent book takes as its heroes the librarians and archivists of Los Angeles County. Her entree to this story was her shock upon hearing for the first time just 3 years ago about the 1986 arson at LA's Central Library. The fire is mostly unknown outside Southern California, overshadowed by the Chernobyl event. But it's our Alexandria, the most devastating library fire in American history.
So we have 400,000 gone, just gone, whole collections. The LA Library had the largest cookbook collection in the U.S. They're out of print. They're gone. I mean, they had car manuals for every make and model of car, starting at the Model T.
Irrecoverable.
Yeah. It had been developed. Librarians developed these collections over the years, finding these books, putting them together. So each library is also unique in that way. What's in the New York Public Library is not the same as what's in the LA Public Library, besides the core stuff. And while you can quantify it, you can say 400,000 books, the library was founded at the turn of the century. Many of these collections had been built from that time. And that can't be fixed by money. And it's like Fantasia. It's an incredibly beautiful building that is a sort of combination Art Deco, Egyptian.
Downtown.
Right in the center of downtown. And this was the central library of the entire LA library system. In 1986, it was in bad shape. It was a time when downtown LA was in bad shape. People weren't even sure that it was important to have a library downtown.
I mean, Los Angeles has changed. It's unrecognizable from when I first came here. No one lived inland. No one lived in Silver Lake and Los Feliz. The air quality was so poor that everybody lived as far west as they could afford. And nobody lived downtown. Describe what happened.
Yeah. April 1986, a fire alarm went off, and everybody thought it was a false alarm. The library had a lot of false alarms. And lo and behold, firefighters found smoke in the fiction section. Suddenly, it absolutely erupted. I mean, you can imagine a fire
books.
In the library.
Yep.
It's the perfect environment. More than that, it wasn't only that it was books. It was in the stacks, which are almost like chimneys. They were thick concrete-walled tubes filled with books. Biggest library fire in the history of the U.S., which at the time I heard about it, which was very recently, I'm shocked. You would assume there would be coverage in the New York papers. So I went back to look at what was going on that somehow obscured this news. There is a little story on the front page in the New York Times saying radiation detected in Scandinavia was the Chernobyl meltdown. And I had kind of forgotten how terrifying that had been. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And it really was days of the New York Times being wall-to-wall Chernobyl coverage because none of us knew if this fallout was going to end up traveling around the world. In fact, it did.
But the Chernobyl, I don't want to digress on this, but I had lived in
Los Angeles pretty much full time. The only time of my life that I lived only in L.A. was 83, 84, 85. And in December of 85, I moved back to New York.
Oh, so you just missed the fire.
I commuted back and forth forever, but I was mostly in New York. And Chernobyl was in 86.
Yeah.
And I was living in New York at the time and remember that vividly. But never heard a word about this fire. Never.
Yeah.
So how do you first become familiar? How does this cross your desk, so to speak?
I had just moved to L.A. and I was offered a tour of Central Library by the head of the Library Foundation because I'd done a little fundraising thing for them. And I thought, well, I've never actually been to Central Library in L.A. And libraries had really come back into my consciousness when I had a kid and started taking my son to the library and was reminded so powerfully of what it is like as a child to go to a library. And it was really vivid and very poignant for me because my mom had just developed Alzheimer's and I was thinking a lot about our trips together to the library. So libraries were on my mind. When I was offered this tour of Central Library, I thought, oh, great. So I went down there, was really struck by the building because it's so beautiful. And as we were walking through on this tour, Ken Brecker, who is the head of the foundation, pulled a library book off the shelf and he took a deep whiff of it.
Wow.
And
how interesting.
I thought, well, I guess I'm new to L.A. Maybe that's the way people do it here.
Yeah.
What do I
they
know?
They
snort books.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, that's a nice thought.
Yeah.
And he said, you can still smell the smoke in some of them. And I said, oh, did they used to allow smoking in the library?
Of course.
And he looked at me like I was crazy. Of course, he said, no, the fire. And I said, what fire? And he said, the big fire, the fire in 86 that shut the library down for 7 years. And my jaw just dropped and I said, what? Tell me about this. And how did I never hear about it? Because the more I learned and the more I learned the scope of the fire, the more amazed I was that was one of those stories that was kind of hiding in plain sight. So my interest in writing about libraries then had this hook because besides just being a chance to write about my feelings about libraries, it was a chance to write about this event that was fascinating. I mean, both the investigation into it, the reason that I didn't know about it, the library's recovery from it, and all of the emotions around it, which were really powerful because obviously people in L.A. knew about this. And for 7 years, that library was closed, the main library.
Was the head of the library at that time still around?
He just passed away. We spent many, many, many hours on the phone.
Tell me about him.
He was an amazing character.
What's his name?
His name was Wyman Jones.
Uh-huh.
And he's irascible, arrogant, fascinating, multi-talented guy who was an amateur magician, very talented magician, and jazz pianist who's also this head of libraries. He had come from running the libraries in Fort Worth, Texas, and was the head of the library system in L.A. for 20 years. Very opinionated. He actually believed that Central Library should be torn down and that the land should be sold and there should be a new library built somewhere else. But he conceded the point when public opinion rose up to preserve the building.
So why if back then when the fire happened and it was closed for 7 years and that area isn't favored, so to speak, why did they bother resurrecting the library?
Well, there were a lot of people who made the argument that there was no need for a central downtown library and that the city could function very well just having branch libraries.
And those people who wanted to resurrect it, how did they win the day?
I can't say that people had the ability to see 20 years into the future and realize downtown would be renovated the way it's been because I was downtown in that period of time here as a visitor and no one lived down here. It was desolate at night. So the idea that the library would be a centerpiece in a revitalized downtown sounded ridiculous. But these people really had the hope that downtown would turn into a thriving part of the city. But there were also people saying the building is too small. We should tear it down, sell the land. We'll get all sorts of money for the land. And we'll build another central library
in Culver City.
Somewhere else. Yeah. And that, there was a very strong kind of movement supporting that. Now, looking back, I would say we're really lucky that that didn't happen.
Is there a hero of the preservation cause?
Absolutely. There was a woman named Margaret Bach and another architect named Barton Phelps. A number of architects got together and said, we have to preserve the library. And that actually was the first organized group doing any kind of historical preservation in L.A. So we have them to thank. That grew into being the L.A. Conservancy, which has preserved all these Lautner houses, all these Schindler houses. That wouldn't have happened if the library hadn't been threatened.
Now, describe the devastation of losing that volume of these things. If to them, precious volumes of beautiful books. Who did you talk to about that?
I spent time with a lot of the librarians, who many of whom are now retired, who were here at the time. The librarians were devastated. I mean, they had spent their entire professional lives developing the collections in their departments. Also, and I found this really touching, they were absolutely frantic over the prospect of their patrons not having the library to come to. And the city of LA hired a psychologist to work with the librarians because a lot of them really were suffering kind of PTSD. I mean, they had seen their life's work go up in smoke.
They care. They
yeah.
care about books in a way that, you know, probably you do on par because this is your stock and trade. But, you know, similar, I guess, to art, where there's an inventory of material that exists purely for a humanistic reason. People who work there are horrifically underpaid. I was guided recently by a New York Times writer to the plight of libraries in Iowa. And we were, my wife and I have a charitable foundation, my family, and we were pointed toward this group of people. And there's three libraries she'd been in touch with who were struggling. Two I spoke to, I said to one of them, I said, what do you need? I didn't want to assume anything. I said, what do you need? And how much money? She said, the budget for the library is $5,000.
What?
I said, wait a second. I said, you mean like a day or a week? And she said, no. She said, everybody's volunteers and part-time people and no one's getting
wow.
paid. And she goes, books are given to us. She said, books we don't need. She said, what I need in this library is food. I need money for food because the kids are coming here and asking for food and they want to eat. They're coming from poor homes.
Yeah.
And I thought the average person just can't appreciate how much they must have suffered.
Yeah. A number of librarians' marriages fell apart in the wake of this. They were really depressed.
And out of a job, many
yeah.
of them.
And felt useless, felt they didn't know what to do with themselves. One woman librarian told me she didn't get her period for 4 months after the fire. She was under so much stress and she was so dismayed. I think it's very difficult. I think it would be the only analog I can think of is if your house burned down.
Mm-hmm. When Dick Cavett's house, one of the Seven Sisters houses in Montauk, the Stanford White houses on the bluff there in Montauk, the house burned down.
Ooh.
A good deal of what was his on the personal level was destroyed in the fire. The house was ruined. And for that reason, I keep nothing of any value like that in my Long Island home. It's in storage in the city because I'm terrified of a fire.
It's terrifying. And interestingly, the insurance coverage that a library has covers the building and not the contents. So the insurance did not cover the cost of the lost books. It was like $22 million worth of books. The money had to be raised. It was raised by tiny donations from school kids, big donations from the Getty Foundation, from some of the studios, George Lucas, Sidney Sheldon. There was a real rallying in the city. And I suspect it was a lot of people who had never really before given the library much thought.
Well, of course, all books now in the world we live in exist digitally. Everything is on a file somewhere and backed up, and there's no fear that that's going to be erased forever. This fire, because it was so epic, did it launch some kind of program where people could preserve these books better and in case this happens and these fabled collections aren't lost?
It's interesting because the fire occurred right at the moment when technology was first entering library management. The LA Library at that point switched to an electronic catalog.
Right.
Because even losing the card catalog was devastating.
Problematic.
Yeah. I mean, they had to recatalog.
Who knew what we had?
2 million books. They didn't even know. And that was actually one of those odd pieces of timing, that electronic cataloging was just becoming widely available. So LA had to recatalog all of its books anyway. It was purchasing all of these new books to replace the ones that were lost. But the books themselves, all new books, a digital copy exists.
Right.
But of old books, Google has a huge project where they are digitally scanning old books.
That don't exist on a file. That book is it.
Yeah.
And they're going to make a file.
I mean, for an individual library to do that, it's probably
right. Only Google can do that.
Google can do it.
Thank you, Google.
Yeah. And so we are putting more safeguards in place so that if you had a devastating fire and you lost these rare—
There's a backup.
In many cases now, I think there is a backup. On the other hand, the LA Public Library has the largest or one of the very largest collections of maps and atlases of any library in the country. They have over 200,000.
I read that, yeah.
It would take a very long time and a lot of money for them to digitize all of them. That's the goal, because that would be fantastic to have all those maps, a digital copy of all of them. But it's an enormous amount of work for a library to do.
For me, what I find interesting with a book like this, you don't make it into a detective story. You don't build this book in that way. This book is a lot of history. How does the book begin to emerge, and how do you piece together? I guess what I'm asking is, how does Susan Orlean write a book? What do you do?
I'm still trying to answer that question, actually, for myself. But what I do, I have a— my approach is to throw my net as wide as possible in the beginning, to have no preconceived idea of what the book is
about.
Show
me everything.
Just, I want to learn everything. The way I look at it is, in the beginning, I'm a student. I'm doing a graduate course in the library history, the history of this particular incident with the fire, the people who work there, the people who work there now, what the day-to-day life is of a library. And in the course of it, you know, and the history of arson and the history of burning books in the course of world events, which sadly has been a theme since the beginning of time. As I'm doing all of this and gathering so much material, themes begin emerging to me. And what this was about was storytelling. We are creatures who tell stories. We preserve stories. And we make stories up about ourselves.
We treasure them.
And I feel like this was about the story of the library, and the library is the repository of stories. The people who became very interesting to me in the book, like Harry Peake, the person who is accused of starting the fire, of Charles Lummis, one of the really fascinating characters who ran the library, these were people who made up stories about themselves, who created stories around who they were in the world, even more than the average person. So as that theme began to emerge, it helped me organize this material and begin pruning away at what was important for me to know but wasn't important to put in the book. I chose to start the book with Harry Peake because I think people are more interested in people than they are in places or events, that a book that invites you in through a character is often one that you're willing to keep reading. And he, as a person who was a compulsive storyteller, otherwise known as a liar, he symbolized so much of what the book was. He's a kind of classic creature of L.A., a wannabe actor, a dreamer, a drifter.
How old at the time of the event?
He was in his 20s, and he also kind of intersected with L.A. history in a very interesting way. And I won't necessarily tell you the denouement of his story, so that will leave a little bit of mystery. But even the way he left this earth was very much a part of what was going on historically. In Los Angeles, yeah. But my challenge is I like writing about things I don't know anything about. So I begin as a student, and then I become a teacher. And I try to turn to readers and say, let me teach you about this amazing thing I learned about. And like a teacher, I have to figure out, how can I tell you this story in the most compelling way that keeps you engaged? And I don't have to include every single thing that I learn, because there's just too much, but instead create a narrative that will bring you into the story, and you can follow the journey of learning about why this topic interested me.
Susan Orlean, New Yorker writer and the author of The Library Book, about the 1986 LA library fire. If you're as fascinated as I am by all things New Yorker, you should listen to my interview with the intrepid Tina Brown. Coming from Vanity Fair, she was greeted with skepticism when she took over the New Yorker in 1992.
It was much more open warfare against me at the New Yorker at the beginning, you know, because we had this huge kind of pushback from the old guard, expecting that this was going to be me putting Demi Moore in the magazine. I mean, for instance, the cartoonist, Bob Mankoff, he thought that I was going to cancel all the cartoons and just put pictures in.
Hear the full interview with Tina Brown in our archive at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Now, more of my conversation with New Yorker writer Susan Orlean. In February 1987, 10 months after the worst library fire in American history, the LAPD arrested a man named Harry Peake.
He confessed to starting the fire, and then he recanted. He confessed multiple times, actually, and recanted multiple times with different alibis each time.
Is it assumed that that was coached by an attorney? Did a lawyer coach him?
He didn't even have a lawyer for the first several times that he confessed and recanted. This was, he confessed to friends, and friends turned him in, as one's friends do. There was a reward. Right. He had confessed multiple times to friends. He confessed to the police in a casual interview where they were simply saying, what were you doing that day? Where were you? What happened?
And these are days prior, no video cameras that are getting people
right
going in and out.
There were simply security keeping people from coming in too early. There is no record.
Or take your feet off the table.
Exactly.
Very
and don't
modest,
eat potato yeah chips on the rare
too
bus.
Loud.
Yeah.
It's,
and
it
be
weird?
Quiet. And even today, libraries are open to anybody. Anyone can come in.
Yeah.
That is both their greatest strength and sometimes their greatest challenge.
I did this movie with Emilio Estevez. He did this movie, The Public. And it's about a guy who's on the staff of the Cincinnati Public Library who joins a protest by homeless people who are denizens of the library and a bane to the board of the library.
Mm-hmm.
They stage a demonstration and they seal off a section of the library and take over and have a protest, have a demonstration. And the movie just screened at the Toronto Film Festival, did quite well with very
good
response. Yeah, we all went up there, Michael K. Williams and
I love
Taylor Schilling and all these wonderful actors who were
wow
in the film. And Emilio plays the lead role. And the support he's gotten from the library community is really, really wonderful.
They are a warm, friendly, welcoming place full of interesting stuff, costing nothing. And there aren't that many places in our world that exist like that. Yeah. So there was no record of Harry P. coming into the library, as there was no record of anybody coming into the library.
And in regards to him confessing and recanting, did he indicate any motive? Why did he do it? Once he confessed to it, the next question is why.
He never said why.
He never articulated that.
The library opens for employees earlier than it does to the public. So a door is open. A security guard sits there to make sure you have an employee badge to get in. On that morning, a young man started walking in. The security guard stopped him and said, "The library is not open." And the young man apparently was annoyed by being stopped and left. The city's final explanation for why they believed Harry Peake did it, on top of the fact that he had confessed, was that he was angry that the guard had turned him away.
Well, I want to get into the Apple store early, too, but did anybody venture what was wrong with him? Did they get into his mental health? And
that's part of what the mystery is, because usually people who are pyromaniacs generally display that behavior fairly early in life. It's very rare for someone in their 20s who has no history ever and has never been
to torch the L.A. Central Library. Did experts determine how the fire was set?
It's a big question. Arson is one of the most difficult crimes to analyze and investigate.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's the least successfully prosecuted felony for that very reason. Usually, the means of starting a fire get destroyed in the fire. And believe it or not, libraries until the late 80s did not have sprinkler systems. Librarians
which I find horrifying.
It's pretty shocking.
A library.
They didn't have sprinkler systems because the worry was water is as damaging or more damaging.
If they went off accidentally, someone set them
off.
Right.
Someone lights a match to, and
sneaking a cigarette back in the
70s. And then, boom, you've got your sprinkler systems going off and your books are going to be ruined. So the American Library Association, until the late 80s, advised against sprinkler systems. And this was before they had systems that use gas and
smoke detectors.
Yeah. I mean, this was not basically fire prevention at that time was a sprinkler that would get triggered and send
water.
And douse
all the product.
Yeah. In fact, a great number of the books that were ruined in the fire were ruined by water firefighters were using.
Like always in fires. Yeah. Now, you grew up in Cleveland.
Yes.
And what did your dad do?
He was a real estate developer.
And your mom?
Mostly a mom and part-time worked in a bank.
When you were growing up in that household, what were books in your childhood and what was your relationship
Everybody
to literature?
Everybody was a big reader.
They were.
My parents were great library goers and they grew up in the Depression. I think they felt, as many people who grew up in the Depression felt, if you could borrow something, why would you buy it? They were not big on buying books. It was to them a luxury that didn't make sense. You could borrow a book. So we would go to the library all the time. I grew up going at least once a week, if not twice a week, taking books out. I didn't start buying books till I was in college. And I think I was buying textbooks and suddenly became obsessed with owning books. My parents, to the day they died, they had the money to buy books. They lived through the Depression and they were very comfortable and could have afforded any books they wanted. It was something that was embedded in them, that you borrowed books from the library and you didn't buy them. So we didn't have a lot of books in my house.
Even when I go to Barnes & Noble, I love it. And I just sit there. I get the same feeling. I'm in a room full of books. Doesn't matter whose name is on the door.
Yeah.
By Lincoln Center, the one by 66th and Broadway,
they
closed.
Now.
And when it closed, that was my Barnes & Noble. I was devastated.
Yeah.
Not even the big one on 80th.
80th and Broadway. That was
mine. The old Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I didn't go to that one. I didn't like that as much as that one by Lincoln Center. I loved that bookstore. When it closed, I was so sad.
Oh, it's a heartbreak.
Now, I want to ask you, because we are going to run out of time, how does writing congeal in your life? Like, when do you decide that's what you're going to do with your life? I mean, that's a big commitment.
I started writing when I learned to read. And I never thought I would be anything other than a writer. I wrote little books for my family when I was really young. I'm not trying to say I was a prodigy. Writing always seemed to me to be the filter through which experience made sense to me. Communicating, telling stories seemed like a natural transaction between me and the world.
Yeah.
It was just what I wanted to do. When I was probably in college, I realized what I really wanted to do was tell true stories. I didn't want to write fiction. I wanted to learn about the world and particularly learn about things that they hadn't noticed or hadn't thought about before. And trying to figure out how you do that for a living was, of course, a bit of a challenge. But when I discovered The New Yorker, I thought, aha, I get it now. This is where you write those kinds of stories, where you examine life and tell their stories. So it was my dream to work there, and I'm lucky enough to – and I've never done any – I waitressed, but other than that, I've never done any other jobs.
You think that Orchid Thief was your most cinematic book?
Well, the funny thing is I think none of them are, and yet—
So what surprised you about that? I mean, they made this into a very famous movie. Did that surprise you when they came and said, we want to make a movie?
Completely surprised me. In fact, when it was optioned, and it was optioned immediately before I had even finished the book, I thought, I have no idea what these people think they're doing. It's a very discursive, sort of reflective, internal book. I cannot imagine how you're going to make a movie out of this. But— that's not my problem. That's your problem. And I remember saying to a friend, they're going to have to make the crime be a murder or something more dramatic than just stealing orchids. It's just impossible. And there's going to have to be some sex in it somehow. And lo and behold, there you go. I mean, when I got the script for adaptation, I read it and thought, you people are crazy. I don't know what you're doing, but at least I'm right. You did have to put in a murder and a car crash. I've had this funny relationship with Hollywood that I write things that I want to write, and they are not conventional in any way in terms of Hollywood's sense of a story, and yet—
they come knocking.
They come knocking, and I'm delighted.
And you don't want to write screenplays?
Well, I've never particularly been interested in it, but we are adapting this book for television, and I thought, you know what, I'm gonna give it a shot. I think it would be fun to try a different kind of writing.
That's cool.
But there's so many things I want to write about out in the world that I've never said I want to be the one to adapt my work. I've always found it mostly people option my work, and I think I have no idea what you are going to do with this. So just call me when it's done, and I'll come to the premiere.
Yeah.
I'm very happy. Give me a few days' notice so I can get my dress to the dry cleaner.
That's how I feel about movies I'm in.
Really?
I don't want to see the movie. They'll say, oh, you want to see a cut of the movie? I'm like, no. I'll come to the premiere.
I suppose now that I live in L.A., my interest in working on the adaptation of this book is more than it was when I lived in New York. Because I'm going to work on it with a friend who's a wonderful writer.
It's more conducive to be out here, maybe.
Yeah. But
what do you think living in L.A. is going to do to your writing?
Boy, I wonder about it, except, you know, the stories that I'm interested in writing, I think, are the same that they've always been. And I don't see a big change in that regard.
Okay.
I've lived in a lot of different places since I began writing. I lived in Boston, in New York, in upstate New York, in Boston again, now in L.A., and my writing has remained really consistent. I think there are stories that I'll find out about because I live here that I might not have seen otherwise. But in the heart of the writing, I feel that that's such an internal thing that where you're living doesn't affect it as much.
You're married to John Gillespie?
Last time I checked.
Worked at the Lampoon.
He did, and is a very
funny
guy.
Does he crack you up all the time? Is he funny?
He's very funny. He's very funny. But he also says to me that the classic Lampoon response to someone else making a joke is to simply, with a very straight face, say, uh-huh. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I co-wrote a book with Kurt Anderson.
Oh, so you know.
And Kurt did 95% of the writing. And Kurt and I did the Trump parody book. Kurt wrote a book called You Can't Spell America Without Me. It's a parody. And what was so riveting, and it was truly just overwhelming to me and just mesmerizing, was how fast the book came out of it. He wrote it in just like weeks. It just came. He'd send me chapters, and I was overwhelmed by how. And I give him notes.
He's so productive, yeah.
And he's so funny.
So he and my husband were together, and there were a lot of people who emerged from that couple of years. Well, the Lampoon has always churned out amazingly clever, smart people. But that particular year, there were a lot of people who've gone on to have quite illustrious careers.
Is he still writing now?
My husband?
Yeah.
He wrote a book about corporate boards and how bad they are. But mostly he's been in the financial world.
Got it.
Which is funny in its own way.
He finds the funny
Exactly.
Well, I want to say, because we're pretty much out of time, but I just want to say, in my town, Massapequa, Long Island, the Massapequa Public Library, and a very nice library, and it was centrally located. It wasn't like on some outpost where they could get cheap land, you know what I mean? It was right in the heart of town. You just got that special feeling of going to the library. You went to the library, and you were groomed almost, because my father was a teacher, I guess this is a part of it. Oh, there's an opportunity for me here. Something's going to happen here. This is a sacred place of real deliberation. We're going to sit, we're going to learn about the research for school, obviously, and looking up, you know, about Arvar, Nunez, Cabeza de Vaca, and the explorers we would study when we were in the sixth grade, and they had two of the old-style bookmobiles that would be taken on the trailer hitch, and it was parked in the parking lot of a 9-hole public golf course that existed in my neighborhood, and the parking lot of the golf course was across the street from my house.
Oh, God.
And we would walk across the street and go into this funky, weird...
Like a trailer?
Bubble. It was like a little trailer. And the woman was sitting at the desk. It was almost like it was like doll furniture. It was like a little desk she was at. And the books had all the little wooden slats to keep them from flying off the shelf. They had like these little guardrails they snapped on them when they traveled so they wouldn't come flying when was driving. And I get a phone call from the Massapequa Public Library, and they say, you know, this is over. You know, we're going to take these things. We're going to junk them. Would you like to buy one? I bought it.
Oh, you're kidding.
Stuck it in a little corner of my property on Long Island, and I put trees around it because my neighbors complained. My neighbors said to me, why do you have these decrepit structures? They said, what is this? These are real Hamptonites, shall we say. One woman said to me, she goes, I didn't realize we were living in Appalachia.
Oh, God.
She said
That's
to me.
Horrible. Well, yeah,
but I remember that feeling, you know, of going to that and getting those books. And you knew the value, the plastic coating on them to protect the covers and everything. And I remember the sacred experience of handling that material.
And I think that, you know, I love bookstores too, and I love owning books. But libraries, there is something special and sacred about the idea of it being a shared space with shared things that we, as a society, have created this entity, and we all share in it together, and it works almost all the time. You take a book home, you read it, you bring it back, someone else takes it. It is democratic, small d, experience in the most really beautiful way. And going into a library and seeing a scholar and a teenager and a homeless person and a wealthy person, and everyone has the same right to take the books. It feels great.
It's like how I assume some people feel when they go to church. It feels right.
Yeah.
It feels good.
It makes me feel, I get very emotional about it. I mean, and I'm going into a bookstore I love and it feels amazing and I want everything and I love walking around. That element of thinking, wow, we can really do things together as a society and have it work, is particular to a library, and it feels so gratifying.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing a movie of this, because something tells me, like Orchid Thief, it's an unlikely subject into something that could become a very, very engaging film.
Thank you.
I hope it makes it to the screen in some fashion.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm excited about it, and I think it will be a pleasure to highlight this world of libraries in some way, because they really, especially at this moment in time when so much else feels so dark and troubled.
At risk.
They are real beacons in the world at the moment. And there's something about being in a room full of books. There's nothing else like it.
You want to snort them.
I do. That, now I know it's completely acceptable in L.A. to snort a book. I'm gonna.
Susan Orlean's latest The Library book, about the devastation of the L.A. Central Library in 1986, is in stores now from Simon & Schuster. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.